Greetings and salutations, everyone. This is AC2GS. My name is Roy, and I am Net Control Operator for this, the Limark Technical Net. Limark Technical Net has been going strong for over 40 years. Every Sunday night at 8 p.m., we gather together and learn from each other. Most of those 40 years was under the guidance of Dick, K2RIW, who unfortunately became a silent key a few years ago. And so in his memory, we continue this technical net and hopefully inform, entertain, learn, and teach. So I hope that you're all out there ready. I hope that you're in the mood to participate. Let me drop for a second, and I will tell you about the usual links. Okay. We used to have this thing called mailbag questions. It used to be very popular. That was for people who couldn't get into the repeater. They would email a member of the technical net, and it would be read to Dick, and Dick would answer the question as though the person had showed up on the net. So if you have a mailbag question, a question you can't get to ask on the net, that would be a reason to email me. Another is to either volunteer to do a discussion on a topic or to be part of a discussion of a topic or to just listen to a given topic that you are particularly interested in hearing about in the field of amateur radio, of course. Also, we always look for puzzles. I'm always looking for interesting puzzles, preferably those that can't be answered by a Google search. So if you have one of those to share, please inform me. Also, if you want me to tap Paul on the shoulder for a NASA or space-related story and have his opinion about it, you can email me at mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. You can directly email Paul at spacenetreport@gmail.com. We also have a link page. If I find interesting articles of science, technology, and what have you, I write them down. I put them in a link page, and you go to your browser. You type in roy.ac2gs.com, and that'll bring you the link page. We update it every week, and we keep it forever and ever and ever. So if you don't have a chance until even next week, you could still pull it up. So, again, that's roy.ac2gs.com. We have a chat room. Sometimes it's very active. Sometimes it's very quiet. The way to get to our chat room is to type into your browser chat.ac2gs.com. We have an audio stream for those people who don't have access to radio or Echolink. If you type into your browser technet.ac2gs.com, that will give you an audio stream of the W2VL Glen Oaks repeater. We keep that going 24/7. So if you need to hear the repeater and you don't have a radio, you just use that browser. And I'd like to remind everyone of MyKC2NJI has a great archive site called AmateurRadio.tv. It has archives of the technical net going as far back as September of 2006. So keep that in mind. Lots of very useful information. Technical stuff doesn't become incorrect over time. A lot of the information shared by very, very smart hams sits in recorded form on that archive site. Let me drop for a second, and I'll come back and tell you what I have planned for you tonight.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Okay, I guess I overdid things, but you guys know the usual stuff. MyKC2NJI's amateurradio.tv and the audio stream technet.ac2gs.com and the chat room chat.ac2gs.com. Let me drop again and then I'll come back and tell you what I have planned.
Yeah, well, it was only about 15 seconds. And good evening, WS1.
Thank you, Paul. Very good. Okay. So it's going to be a regular type of a TechNet tonight. I don't, unfortunately, have any guest speakers. Always looking for them, though. So if you have a subject that you're keen to expouse upon, please let me know via email, and we'll set something up. Anyway, We will accept questions and comments, hopefully initially amateur radio related, but as time goes on, we will kind of open it up wide. Any science and technology is fair game, even medicine if you want, but keep in mind we do not treat nor diagnose over the radio. I have a micro puzzle, a very simple little thing that hopefully I'll find a spot in the middle of tonight to plant it. That should take us to 10:15. Paul will then come on WS2N with the SpaceNet report, which will take us to approximately 11 p.m., and I will return and put a bow on it and wish you well for the week. That's the plan, if the universe allows and the laws of physics continue to work the way they do and my radio continues to work the way it does. Anyway, so that's the plan for tonight. So with that in mind, please, if you're out there and you have any questions or comments of a technical nature, please hit that push-to-talk button and give me your first name and your call sign.
PZ?
Rich recognized. Anyone else want to put their name down on the list for tonight?
With a medical sensory type question.
Okay, unfortunately you doubled with Wes, so could you repeat that?
WA to VDH with a medical sensory type question.
Okay, John. Anyone else want to put their name on the list? Please give me your first name and your call sign.
Into exam. It would be around the medical questions, but subject. But it's mostly science fiction.
Okay, understood, Wes. Anyone else out there who has any questions or comments for tonight and would like to be put on the list?
I guess I'll throw my call out there, but I don't really have anything at the moment. KD2OGB, and just got in my car, mobile.
Okay, Craig. I don't know exactly how to write that in there as a maybe possibly kind of I guess we'll see as time develops. If and when you come up with a question, we'll check even on you again later on and see if you have a question. And I guess at that point, if you don't, you can just pass.
You know what? I got something in mind right now.
Okay, so we'll put you in the number three slot. That's fine. Once again, I am AC2GS. My name is Roy, and this is the Limark Technical Net. So if anyone out there has any technical questions or comments of a technical nature, reports to make on previous discussions we've had with them, and they've gone and found out something interesting and would like to share it, all those things are grist for the mill. So if there's anyone out there with any of that stuff, please hit that push-to-talk button and put your name on the list.
A2GJE, just a comment. Glen Oaks is noisy tonight, but Selden is loud and clear, perfect quiet, over.
Something tells me the link is failing again.
Okay, I don't know what the problem is. I don't think the link has been addressed yet. I could be wrong. Thankfully, we do once again have our Echo Link back. We didn't have that for a couple of weeks. The technical crew had to fix that problem. But I think the link is still in the process of being fixed. I might be wrong. But we'll do as best we can under the circumstances. The technical staff crew of the repeater is a thankless task. They work very hard for no pay. And occasionally only for compliments and not enough. So I take my hat off to them all. They work very hard to allow us to have all these repeaters that we take advantage of.
I don't think it's the link tonight, Roy. Selden is perfect quieting. It's Glen Oaks is noisy, over.
Okay. I don't know why, but at least I'm getting through. There was, I think it was about 6 or 8 months ago, for some strange reason, I started to the net, and I was able to get through, and then I started to break up, apparently, and then it just completely lost me, and I had to finish the rest of that technical net on Echolink. So even if it's a little noisy, as long as everyone's received and everyone is repeated back, I'm a happy camper. Okay, so let's start with the questions, and of course, if we have time, we'll open it again. And people who don't have questions right now but develop questions later, you know, they'll have an opportunity, hopefully. So first on the list is Rich, W2BZ. What's your question or your comment for tonight, Rich?
Good evening, Roy. Good evening, everybody. I just want you to clarify the differences between open spot 3 and open spot 4. I sort of missed what the upgrade was about, so could you do that? Could you address that, please?
Sure. I probably don't have every detail because it's not like they send me anything, so it's based upon their website and email messages. It appears to me that they've upgraded the microprocessor, the electronics, to make it a little bit snappier and perhaps a little bit more energy efficient. They might have tweaked the battery storage capacity, because they were promoting the fact that the battery lasts longer in this new model that they've come out with. Also, they've decided to kind of split it into two versions. As people recall, the OpenSpot 2 was kind of a simple design, very similar to the Raspberry Pi design. With the OpenSpot 3, they included their own dual transcoder. In other words, the voice is encoded and decoded from audio to a digital stream and back again. Usually in the older OpenSpots and in the Raspberry Pi versions, this transcoding is done at the level of a radio. That's why you need to have a particular digital radio to interface with the hotspots. The OpenSpot 3 didn't require that because it had its own internal transcoders. So that meant that you could either use any radio for any gateway. In the past, if you had a D-Star radio, you could only use it to get to a D-Star gateway. And if you had a Fusion, or if you had a DMR, you could only use Fusion DMR. With the OpenSpot 3, you could have it anyway. Plus, you could even have the audio output onto a computer using a web browser. Let me drop for a second. Okay. I think one of the things that they picked up on was that obviously added a cost to the equipment. You couldn't get a dual Ambi chip for free, so it added a considerable cost for the OpenSpot 3. And some people didn't particularly want or care for the feature. So in OpenSpot 4, my understanding is that they've split the Model 4 to one with a transcoder and the ability to interoperate with any digital radio and also have the audio come out on a computer web browser, and a less expensive model that didn't have a bilateral transcoder. So there are two versions of the OpenSpot 4 now. I think that's the gist of it.
So does this mean with the OpenSpot 4, with one or both versions, it sort of defeats Yaesu's exclusivity. Because they were trying to lock everybody out, as you know, with Fusion. So does that mean if you have an Anytone 868, 878, that you could go on the Fusion network without any problems?
Ah, once again, semantics. You can go on a Fusion network. You can't get on to Wires X because Wires X is a proprietary network owned by Yaesu, and they do not allow anything but Yaesu products to interface with that network. Now, individual people can use a Yaesu device to get into a Wires X room, and then they can use other electronics to create a gateway that then feeds it to a talk group or a Wires X outside of their network room, or even a reflector. So you can still personally configure your own gateways to each room, but Yaesu will not allow any hotspot to directly connect to their backbone of their Wires X rooms. But there are a lot of people who are just accessing it and putting it through a gateway on their own. But Yaesu doesn't want to directly allow that.
So it doesn't seem like there's any more access that they're giving people between OpenSpot 3 and OpenSpot 4. It's the same access. It might just be a more efficient piece of hardware. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. The basic premise is there's no real improved, as far as I'm aware, functionality. It's just the processor and the battery is a little bit more efficient and a little bit faster at booting up. And because they split it into two models, for those people who do not want to pay extra for a dual AMBI chip, you can buy the less expensive model. But as far as feature set is concerned, I do not know of any additional new feature that they've implemented in 4 that wasn't available in 3.
Still a little cloudy on the dual AMBI chip. If you don't go for the dual AMBI chip, you don't have access to what? Fusion networks?
If you don't go for the OpenSpot 4 with the dual AMBI chip, then you have to rely on the AMBI chip on the radio that you're using. So if you're using a Fusion Handy Talkie or a Fusion base station, that has an AMBI chip in it, and you could use that, and that will get you both into Fusion-related gateways, and because the same AMBI chips are used, you could also use it to get into DMR gateways. You cannot get into reflectors because the AMBI chip is slightly different in the D-Star radios. The same way, if you're using a D-Star Handy Talkie or regular base station radio, you can only go to a D-Star gateway using that type of a hotspot. With the OpenSpot 3, it would be open to everything. But because D-Star uses one type of AMBI chip and Fusion and DMR uses another, there's a bifurcation, and you need some radio that has an AMBI chip. That's why with the ones with built-in AMBI chips on the hotspot, you can open up a web browser and you can listen to the audio stream on your computer because it's using the AMBI chip in the hotspot. Whereas the ones that don't have AMBI chips, you can only decode the messages on your radio.
So it seems like a much ado about nothing in a way, except for giving people the choice of, you know, dual AMBI chip or not. Maybe they're just, did they really come out with a whole upgrade just to make the battery last longer?
I don't know because I'm not part of the company. My assumption is that they really didn't see any useful additional feature that was cost effective, that was relatively easy to roll out, and I think they kind of felt the squeeze from people who don't really need a transcoder in their hotspot. You know, they're used to all the other Raspberry Pi type of devices that are already less expensive, and this just added an additional cost to the OpenSpot 3. So for the people who kind of looked at the price of OpenSpot 3 and said, it's a feature I don't need, why do I have to pay more for it? I think that's kind of one of the reasons, as opposed to, I think it would have really clouded the water if they all of a sudden came out with a kind of a cheap version of the Raspberry 3, you know, like Apple tends to do. They put an S at the end of, 6S, and that means that it's a little bit less expensive than the original 6, and they're going to sell you a 7 if you have the money, but if you don't have the money and you got to save a couple of bucks, you go for the 6S. So rather than do that, I think that was what was going on. And, you know, as time goes on, chipsets become more powerful and or more efficient. So they just retooled for the next iteration of the processors and promoted it thanks to their marketing department. But I think the primary difference is that you could get a less expensive, a less feature-packed version for less money.
Roy, this Rich, I just heard about a minute and a half of nothing but a dead carrier.
Okay, let me try one more time. Do you hear me now?
Went down at the moment, listen to Glen Oaks. Sheldon has no audio.
I hear you with no problem.
WS 1.
I hear you with no problem.
Okay, where do you hear me, AC2GS? And if you do, which repeater are you listening to?
The link is failing.
Ah, gee whiz, the link is failing. We mentioned it, and I guess it's a matter of a Kanahara. I don't know what to tell you, guys. I hope you hear me right now. I know that the Echo Link hears me because I can see the Echo Link working.
Echo Link's 100% N2H3R.
Okay, very good.
Alpha Bravo 6, can you hear 100% too, 86MB.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Nick. Thank you, Jeff. Jeff AB6MB, of course, is the net control operator for the Papa Networks antenna TechNet every Friday night, 10 o'clock Eastern time. There are different ways of getting into the Papa Network, but if you're interested in antennas, and who isn't, every Friday night at 10 o'clock, take a listen to the Papa Network. Very, very good technical net. But anyway, it's good that the Echo Link hears me. Let's get back to Rich. Do you hear me now, or still there's a problem?
WATCDL, Roy.
Yes, Andy.
I'm listening. There's no audio coming from the link, so he's not going to hear you. I'm listening to the link right now. Steve's going to be up there tomorrow. Okay, just came back. Now the audio came back. Now I hear it. So ask the question now. Talk to him because now the audio is back. It just came back.
Okay, thank you very much, Andy. It's a shame I can't kind of pull up any kind of indication of when it's up, when it's down, because I follow a lot of things here. I follow Echolink, I follow IRLP, all kinds of things. But anyway, Rich, W2BZ, can you once again hear me on the link?
Now I can, Roy, but for the last 3 or 4 minutes, there was nothing but sounded like a dead carrier.
Yes, Andy, WA2CDL, told me that the link was down for that period of time, so we'll just have to suffer through it as best we can. To answer your question once again, I don't know the internal tinkerings with the company. I just know what they advertise to people. I assume that they took a perceived hit when they brought out the Open Spot 3. Open spots have always been a premium, very well-designed, well-built product, but you pay a price for them. So you're definitely going to cost you more than a Pi-Star-based system. So I think when they brought out the Open Spot 3, they had a problem with some people who didn't feel that they needed the transcoding, the built-in AMBI chip, and the price for the built-in dual AMBI chip, and they suffered in sales. And rather than kind of bring out the, as Apple might do, the Open Spot 3S for the smaller, cheaper model, I guess they simply just were watching the chips that were being developed. They are getting a little bit more efficient and powerful, so they just upgraded to the next version of the chipset, and they split the model in two and renamed it Open Spot 4. That would be my guess.
I got it now. Again, as I said before, it seems like splitting it, Open Spot 4 is really just splitting Open Spot 3 into two versions with some tweaks to the hardware. It seems like not a very revolutionary upgrade, but I got it now, Roy. Thanks a lot. W2BZ.
You're welcome, Rich. I mean, as far as I'm aware, I don't know exactly what more they could kind of do. It's kind of at the peak of what you expect out of a hotspot. You could only access networks that the network control operator will allow you to access. So for those that are proprietary and locked down as the Wires X rooms are, there's nothing much you can do about that, no matter what you design. You know, even if it was 10 times the price, if you came out with $1,000 hotspot, it still wouldn't be able to kind of get across their server blocks, at least not legally. So I think that this is kind of the best that you could ask for. I again, don't know of any other feature that would particularly be terribly useful. Maybe if you kind of automated the whole kind of plug system, which would sort of make it a different device entirely, I would think, because there are people kind of playing around with that. You see there's a DMR, I think it's DMR-based handy-talkie that sort of looks like a cell phone, where it has software in it that's supposed to make it easier to get into talk groups and not have to deal with code plugs. But, you know, that's the only additional feature set I can think of for a hotspot. Anyway, hopefully that answers Rich's question. Anyone else have any questions on this particular subject? We kind of covered it, I think, last week. But hotspots are a big thing for a lot of people. Some people never use them, but a lot of people, most of their communications are done through hotspots. Yes, Wesley recognized. Andy, you want to say something?
Yes, in the beginning of the tech that there was a station that came on and said the repeater was weak.
Yes, Ed, K2GJE.
Let me just ask
system. Hey, do you listen?
It's not weak, it's noisy. The repeater at Glen Oaks is noisy. It sounds like someone shoveling coal. Selden is perfectly quieting, over.
Okay, no, I confirm what you say. I'm looking at the signal level, it's down. Usually it comes in around minus 67, 68. It's now coming in at minus 75, so you are correct. Just to let you know, it is down.
KD2AMZ, I concur, because I can pick up Selden from my location. All I get is static.
Steve's going up there tomorrow with Lou, so I'll mention that to them to look at it. Back to you, Roy.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Andy. Wesley, you wanted to say something?
Yeah, just a note from hamradioprep.com in regards to repeaters and hotspots from the receiver side. We have a quarter-wave antenna close to them. It works well, but we are operating in fringe areas much of the time, then 5/8. Vertical antenna may be a better choice. That just may be helpful comment and intuition.
Okay. Different people have different antennas for UHF, VHF. My base stations are collinear. For 10 meters, I have a 5/8 wave. It has a somewhat better takeoff angle, I find. So 5/8 are nice antennas, but collinears also are pretty good antennas.
Yeah, the recommendation is for fringe areas, for 5/8.
Okay, I don't know how that you have a slightly better takeoff angle with a 5/8, so you'll kind of cut across the buildings nearby, I guess. You have a little bit better chance. But, you know, all things being equal, as you put those collinears back to back, it narrows the little pancake image of the radiation pattern and puts a lot more power in the horizontal, where your line of sight should go. So I don't know. I think in terms of simple antennas, probably 5/8 is certainly better, but I don't know exactly if you put a 5/8 next to a collinear, you know, like a GP6 or a GP9, that you would see the same increased benefit of the 5/8 wave that you wouldn't see with a GP6 or GP9.
Well, that article actually points that the taller the antenna, the more gain the antenna will have. And then they stand that in areas close to the repeaters, quarter wave works better, and fringe areas, 5/8 works better. And, of course, taller antenna is more loss on the feed line. But anyhow, that's my 5 cents. Thank you.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Wesley. I guess we'll go to John, WA2VDH. I'm not quite sure if it was a question or a comment, but whatever, please.
Okay, fine business. Yeah, my question has to do with something called binaural beats, where two different audio tones through headphones are fed to each ear. And your brain sort of trains on the difference frequency, like, say, 432 hertz and 435 hertz fed to left and right ear. And then the difference frequency, about 3 hertz, would affect your brain. Your brain would sort of generate the difference frequency, and this would train your brain to the delta wave, which is a lower frequency brainwave. I wonder if is there anything to that as far as meditation, or is there's a lot of Bravo Sierra, as it were. Go ahead.
Well, they do research, and there are articles. Whether it will pan out ultimately, because unfortunately the nature of some research is that there's early promise, and then it just kind of fades away as more and more better designed, larger studies kind of demonstrate that the initial findings was more like static. You know, there's lots of that out there, unfortunately. There are some research studies that suggest that migraine sufferers, and I suffer from migraines. It was one of the things I inherited from my dear father, that green light, that there's a particular wavelength of green light that is more soothing for migraine sufferers. So there are some preliminary studies that suggest that. Then there are later studies that kind of put that in doubt. So it is a real thing, though. It's not that some crystal gazer has come out and profounded upon it. There is some people doing research on the subject that by feeding two slightly off tones where the difference is 3 hertz will kind of do some magic in your brain. That kind of simulates the delta activity in EEGs when you're in a sleep mode. So it requires more study. People will be selling all kinds of stuff. I'm sure there's recordings of all kinds of things that use that principle. And some preliminary studies do suggest the possibility. But will it pan out in the long run? Who knows?
Well, is it the delta wave, which is, I think, the lowest frequency one? Is that the one associated with relaxation and deep sleep? Is that how it works out? Go ahead.
Yeah, delta seems to be the when you're calm, people who are into meditation, when they do a lot of EEG studies, when they kind of get into their groove, their transcendental meditation groove, usually you can pick up a delta wave, 3 hertz signals on the electroencephalogram.
I see. And the other ones, alpha and beta, those are higher frequency associated with more high level of consciousness, or I mean more alertness. Is that how it works?
Yeah. Those are when you're alert. Most of the EEG signals are in the slightly higher frequency. I mean, the problem with electroencephalograms is it's sort of like listening to a radio that has no selectivity. So you hear a lot of different channels simultaneously, and you have to try and make sense of it. So that's sort of the level that an EEG really is. So if there's a power outage in the neighborhood, then you'll notice it, because even though you can't quite make out the individual signals, you know, when they're all out, they're out. So it's better than nothing, but as time goes on, we have far better devices. Functional magnetic resonance imaging devices will tell you which area of your brain lights up when you're thinking different things. So our ability to discern detail is getting better. But EEGs have been a useful piece of equipment for many years, and delta waves, alpha, beta, and such are part of the EEGs.
Oh, okay, fine business. I really appreciate it. That's the only questions I had. I'll turn it back to you, back to Ned.
Okay, very good. I would almost think of trying it as an experiment. I can't. I always like optical illusions. You can't do a single optical illusion on a technical net on a radio. And there was a radio. There was an audio trick where there was a distorted sound that some people perceived as the word Yancey, and other people heard a different word. And I tried that. That was about 3 years ago. Everyone heard Yancey, I think. Our brain works in mysterious ways.
I remember that. There was the Yammy and Laurel
I was able to get it to the point where I could actually will myself to hear Yami or to hear Laurel alternating back and forth. So it was a lot to do with perception.
Well, yeah, I mean, it was pretty much all perception. It also, some people thought that it might have something to do with the spectrum frequency that your hearing was, so that if you didn't have the high-end frequency, it might bias you towards one or the other. I tried that as an experiment also because I think I was the only one who heard Laurel. Everyone else heard Yancey. And so I listened to the recording from the repeater, and I still heard Laurel. So I never quite figured out why I was the only guy that night who heard Laurel.
Yeah, I remember when they closed down the bandwidth, you tended to hear Laurel. But when you had a full high-fidelity bandwidth, I think you heard Yami. So, but I remember, I think you played it over the... over the net, and I think I remember hearing Laurel. Anyway, I appreciate it. Thanks.
Okay, very good. Thank you, John. Craig, hopefully you've polished up that that question that you came up with. What's your question for tonight? Well, Craig, are you out there? Hopefully it's not the link causing problems. I don't know which repeater you usually listen to the technical net on.
Yeah, just give me 3 seconds. I just need to set some stuff down, and I have something in my mouth right now. My hands are full. Just give me 3 seconds.
Okay, no problem, Craig. You have as many seconds as you want. This is again AC2GS, Roy here with the Limark Technical Net.
Did not meant to bring this tripod in, but whatever. So, KD2OGB, not really to rush things, but I kind of really want to get my shack put together at some point. I can't really rely on my mobile in AC forever. I really would like to get some kind of antenna out there. It's just parents are kind of worried, and I don't really, like, want to get anybody, like, freaked out or something. But I really want to tie something someplace. You got any ideas, Roy, for a simple VHF, UHF setup and an HF setup without having to, like, go onto the roof?
Well, for the sake of arguments, let's split the two things up because I know of no combination antenna for HF, UHF, and VHF. So let's first take VHF and UHF. So you're looking for a good dual band. I mean, you might want a tri-band if you're interested in either 1.2 gigs or 220 megahertz, but at least the dual band. The problem with UHF-VHF is, as Dick K2RIW used to say, there are three important things about UHF-VHF, and they're elevation, elevation, and elevation. You will get a much better signal the higher you are able to put up your antenna. So, yes, you can put the antenna on the ground. You could put the antenna 6 feet off the ground, but you're going to get a lot better reception and transmission if you're able to put the antenna up on the roof. Some antennas are not really that obvious, and I have found in my life that An elevated antenna gives people a lot less grief than one that they can just see at level. I was setting up a bunch of antennas to have mounted on my roof, so it started its life in my backyard. And it scared a few people. They were a little bit anxious. As soon as I lifted it onto the roof where they had to actually bend their neck up, they didn't care. So, again, I wouldn't suggest probably something like a GP9, which is 18 feet long, but some reasonable isolinear dual band vertical placed very quietly on the corner of a roof probably shouldn't upset too many people. So that's UHF VHF. But, you know, I would like to get your feedback before we move on to HF.
I would like to get something perhaps fiberglass made for, like, less than $200. In most cases, I found a good dual bander for less than $100. But the biggest thing my parents are worried about, it's not a matter of just doing it safely, considering I haven't really done fixed installations yet, but it's also a matter of being able to do it legally, too, because my brother thinks that, oh, you have to get, like, a permit to do this or that or whatever, or if it's more than 35 feet, blah, blah, blah. Like, what do I do to get around that stuff?
Well, let me ask you an important question. Are you very, very close to an airport?
An uncontrolled one, yes, but I don't really seem to be worried about that.
Okay, I mean, that's the only real rule. There's this a little piddling rule that is related to CBers, where they can't be a certain height in New York City. I don't know. I assume you live in Nassau or Sussex. I don't know of anyone who's really had that much of a problem. I don't know of anyone who's gotten knocked on the doors and said, it's too tall. I mean, of course, if you're planning to put up a 200-foot tower, your neighbors might get rather anxious. But again, that's not what you're planning to do. Again, something like a GP3 or a GP6, I'm talking to you thanks to a GP3. I think they're about 5 feet long. They're made out of fiberglass. They're barely visible. Mine is hidden behind a tree. GP6 is twice as long. Again, it also has a fiberglass outer shell, and the actual radiator is inside the shell for protection. And they give out wonderful signals, and I don't think they'd upset or make anyone particularly anxious.
But then I would have to zip line it to the house or run it under the ground to get to my house and then have it come up, and I don't really know if that would look neat or not.
Okay, repeater's making all kinds of interesting tones. Well, it sort of depends. You do need a transmission line, that's true. You could simply figure out where you want to put your little shack and place the antenna on the roof in the same general location as where that room is located, and then depending upon how many floors difference between the roof and your room, have that length of coax. If you want to be neat about it, you can get the coax stays and screw them into the side of the house, or other people just let them hang a little bit loosey-goosey. You know, you do it in the back of the house. No one really sees it from the front. You know, it depends upon how obsessive-compulsive you want to get. There are neat installations. There are slightly less neat installations. Theoretically, if the length of cable doesn't have to be very long, you could try a thinner length. I wouldn't suggest that because at UHF VHF you get a significant amount of attenuation losses as the lengths increase.
Using brackets or trying to drill into the side or the top, that's what my parents are very kind of worried about. Oh, well, what if this happens or that? And I'm like, oh, boy. Now I need to ask you or Don or whoever it was that knows about this that could probably help me out and kind of teach them a little bit, considering I should know this by now or even look this up. Think of it like this. I would like to have two dual banders, two HF, one normal, one QRP, maybe a tri-bander, a tiny one, and a couple HTs, and my Uniden scanner that I'm looking at right now, only for receiving, just for the public service. That's my setup.
Okay, but that kind of pretty much only tells you how many antennas that you want. Now, keep in mind that the most important is how many antennas you plan to be transmitting on. If there's antennas that you're just going to use to receive a signal, and you know, like scanners and such, you can share the same antenna. You could either use, we mentioned a few weeks ago, an RF splitter. If you want to get into slightly more expensive, they sell splitters that have built-in low-noise amplifiers so that you're not going to have the signal loss that you would if you just use a passive device. So that kind of breaks down it into further segments. How many antennas you just want to use as passive receiving antennas for more than one radio, and how many you want to have individual connections so that you can put transmission power through it without having any other radios hooked up to the same exact source. So that's where the difference is. And again, usually with UHF and VHF, height is the best way of getting the best. If you have the same exact, say, quarter wave radial bare bottom antenna from, say, Radio Shack, which I owned one of, and you place it high, it's incredibly better than one of the more expensive radios if you just plant it low. So, I would try my best, and you don't need to, if you don't want to, tack down the coax cable to the side of the building. You can just let it kind of unfurl, as long as you're not a stickler for clean connections and such. It's just a loop of, people have coax cable all the time. They have cable TV. And a lot of time it's not really secured to the outside of many houses. So you can do that in the back of the house. All you need is something to keep the antenna itself up on the roof. And if you don't want to punch any holes on it, there are stands that come so that you can put cinder block weights around the stand, and the weight of the cinder blocks will keep it on the roof without introducing any holes. So there are always ways to get around things like that. So that's just the UHF, VHF. You know, once we kind of have that figured out, then I'll move to the HF discussion.
Maybe I want to save HF for another time. I at least want to get my foot through with being able to do VHF, UHF in a fixed way. And that's the reason why I kind of want really everything tied into one, so that way if you have more than two antennas, I think that's when you need to do this or that. But there has to be some kind of way that you can tie everything into one and use more than one radio on that source without frying anything. There's got to be a way.
Inevitably, you're going to need some kind of a switch which disables the connections, because there's nothing that I'm aware of. You know, they sell things they call TR switches, transmit receive, and what it is, it's a relay that it locks out the receiving device when you put through power to transmit to that antenna. Because if you just kind of put a Y connector or a splitter and you pour 100 watts into that splitter, you're going to damage the splitter, and some of it is going to bleed through to the front end of the receiver on the other radio. So what people usually do is they either put a splitter and not use it to transmit, or put a switch or a relay, either a passive one where you know that you need to switch it into the transmitter, so you turn the manual antenna switch and you're there, or else have a TR switch that senses the power and automatically will do the switching, or hopefully automatic. But you need something like that. There's nothing, to my knowledge, that simply will let you pass 100 watts through a combined circuit that's connected without a turnoff switch to another receiver's front end. Yes, Sam.
Hi, guys. Everybody. Hi, Craig. highest source antenna that I want to get for the house is a 8-band from MFJ for $400-some, $388, $400. But it takes everything in one, okay? That's 8 bands included, 2 meter, 10 meter, 10, 20, 30, 40. It's all in one. It stands 8 feet tall. It has limbs like arms, like a tree. It has 1, 2, 3 brackets that stand out vertical. And it has arms on it that pick up each different band. But it is one that's all in one. It's 788 number. But MSJ makes one. It's all in one.
Okay, I'm not quite sure if it's 2 meter. Might be. I know it's definitely not 70 centimeters. So if Craig is interested in using the UHF band, he's going to be out of luck.
No, it has 2 meter also. I'm telling you, Roy, it's a beautiful antenna for it's very expensive. And then there's another one called Super Antenna. But the only thing with that is you've got to plug in, like, plugs to each meter, each, place where you want to go, like 10 meter, and you plug the wire in, you go. But no, this one by MSJ is all in one. It's a vertical with 4 different arms and different loads on them, like loads that pick up 10 meter, 20 meter. But 2 meter is 2 meter and 440.
Okay, I kind of doubt that it's 440, but okay. Sometimes, when something is too good to be true, it's usually because it's too good to be true. So all things being equal, personally, I'm a big guy for multi-band antennas. I have fan dipoles that when they're up and operating go from 80 to 10. But, I don't know. I would always kind of have a separate UHF-VHF because I'm pretty sure it's not optimized in any way, shape, or form for either of those two bands. If it's kind of designed to be, doing everything. So, you certainly, Craig is free to kind of look up MFJ. They're kind of a well-known manufacturer of amateur radio equipment. Sometimes some multi-band antennas sound better in print than they are in person. Magic antennas are just shortened verticals with loading coils that are adjustable. They're very inefficient, very lossy, and you have to be around to short out lengths of the coil to tune it for the bands that you want to, which doesn't particularly make it a good antenna to have far away from you. Yes, Paul.
Yeah, originally it sounded like Craig didn't want to attach anything to the roof at all. So I guess you could, if he's going to run the wires, let's say, out through a window from his shack. I'm not sure where he's located in the house, but if your wires go out, and if there's one spot right near the window where you can put up a pole, they have these telescopic poles now. Even the Harbor Freight sells them, You can extend them pretty high, maybe 20 feet high. If you could attach a dual-band vertical antenna for UHF and another one for VHF on top of that, come down with the coax, and you come through into the shack, and now, you know, MFJ, like you said, MFJ makes a switch. You can, you know, you have one for $44. You can switch between two different radios, or if you like, or they, you know, for $124, I think I saw it on the, I just looked it up. You get to, you know, switch between four different radios. But, you know, I would stick with all your ham.